This is an ABC podcast.
Welcome to Medialand, your weekly look at what's happening behind the scenes and on your screens. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Vivian Kelly.
Viv, not much doubt about the media's big news story of the week with the death of Pope Francis.
Yes, it seems we've swapped out Trump stories for J.D. Vance killed the Pope memes.
Coming up, we'll take a look at how the media covered the death of the pontiff. It was unfortunate timing for some. But first, Viv, it's been a crucial week for Google and Meta, with two separate cases being heard in court in the US, both raising the question of breaking them up. What do you think when I mention Google, Viv?
Well, it's more than a company and more than a search engine, Tim. It's a verb in and of itself. When you need to find something out or settle a debate at a pub or find out who that actor was that you saw on that show, you don't search engine it, you Google it, with the exception of that one friend that we all have who refuses to use Google.
That one loser friend who uses Bing. And certainly that is, I think, what most people do think about when they think of Google. They think about search. But the facts of the matter is it's about so much more than that. If you're on a website and you see ads on it, chances are they're probably powered by Google. If you use Chrome, that's them. They own YouTube too. If you have Android, you're part of the Google family.
Oh, I hate to be that person that says I don't have an iPhone, Tim, but I didn't realise that having an Android meant I'm part of the Google family.
How do you know if someone doesn't have an iPhone? They'll tell you. And all of this comes under the banner of parent company Alphabet. So their turnover in Australia is something like $10 billion, easily our biggest media company.
And Meta is almost as big, with the likes of Facebook, WhatsApp, Instagram and Threads. So these cases have been brought forward by Lina Khan. She was the chair of the Federal Trade Commission at the time. And here she is explaining to CNN how to prove a company has a monopoly.
And there are a couple different ways you can do that. One is to kind of do the math, figure out who's in, who's out, and calculate what's the market share. But the other way you can show a company is a monopoly is, can it get away with abusing its customers or making things worse for its customers?
So the Federal Trade Commission is trying to prove that when Meta bought Instagram in 2012 and WhatsApp in 2014, it was doing so to bury the competition. But Meta says everything it did was completely legal and overseen by the regulator. And it reckons that there's plenty of healthy competition out there anyway, with the likes of TikTok, YouTube, X, and Snapchat.
Now, meanwhile, Google has been involved in a case around its search. In August last year, the judge ruled that Google had an illegal monopoly in search. So that included things like deals paying Apple $20 billion a year to be the default search engine on Safari. And this week they went back to court to argue about what to do about that.
That's some big figures there. We're talking about $20 billion a year, but it's not even the only case that Google's involved in, Tim.
Yeah, they've also had a separate ruling just in the last few days that Google illegally dominated the ad tech markets through Google Ad Manager. When you land on your average website, you'll see some ads. Chances are that's probably powered by Google Ad Manager. And what that means is, in the fraction of a second before that page loaded, a little mini auction was going on to decide what ad to show you. And advertisers were deciding how much they were willing to pay. And publishers were deciding whether that was enough. And both sides of that little auction were being run by Google Ad Manager.
Yeah, so many people, when they see an ad for a dress they looked at online a few days ago or a holiday that they flirted with booking, is suddenly following them around the internet. And sometimes they think, is my phone listening to me? Am I being tracked? But it's actually all about this interaction with Google, knowing what you search for, knowing what you're doing on your phone or online, and then selling those ads at that auction to target you directly, right?
Oh, let's not even get too far into privacy this week, Viv. For all of these rulings, not a lot seems to happen in the end.
Yeah, well, these cases are notoriously difficult to get up. All the way back in 1999, the US took on Microsoft, which was accused of leveraging its dominance with Windows that had over 90% market share at the time to suppress its competitors. Notably, I don't know if you can remember this browser, Tim, Netscape Navigator.
Was that before Clippy?
And it was accused of, you know, bundling its Windows platform with Internet Explorer to make it difficult for PC manufacturers to install rival browsers. So at the time, a judge ordered that Microsoft be split into two, separating that Windows operating system from its lovable office products. As you mentioned, Clippy from Microsoft Word, there's Microsoft PowerPoint, Microsoft Excel. But even with that ruling that it be split into those two separate things, it was overturned on appeal. So the Google case is going to be hard to enforce, given that they tried it once and on appeal it didn't work.
Yeah, now we've got the Trump factor as well in a couple of ways. One, it's going to be interesting to see how he reacts to Europe, which has just slapped Apple and Meta with $1.2 billion worth of fines. That's for breaking European Union digital competition rules. Now, in a world of levies, that's really going to be quite interesting to see how that one lands diplomatically. And then there's also the perception that the platforms might just be able to buy Donald Trump's, let's call it, goodwill.
No.
One day this might go somewhere, but I don't think anything's going to happen quickly.
So another story that got my attention this week, Tim, is a new campaign that's being backed by a number of the major commercial media outlets. It's called #StandUpToHate. They've just launched some ads here in Australia, so if you were watching commercial TV on Wednesday night, you might have seen them.
Enough.
No more division.
No more hate.
No more racism.
No more anti-Semitism.
No more Islamophobia.
This country is built on diversity.
On fairness.
On respect.
Everyone is equal.
Everyone deserves to feel safe.
Hate is where it starts.
Here is where it stops.
It's time to stand up to hate.
Now, it's not a message that I disagree with, but...
Good.
No, I think we should all embrace hate. No, but it did get me curious because to me, it seemed a bit half-baked. I don't know that the call to action was strong enough on their website. There's not a call to action beyond a hashtag, which feels quite outdated, particularly because hashtags are predominantly used on social media, which can fuel a lot of hate. And I don't know about some of the people they've picked. You would have heard voices there from the likes of Kyle Sanderlands and Eddie Maguire, all who have had controversies for saying allegedly hateful or problematic things.
Quite unusual, I suppose, just sort of how this one all came about. It first popped up as an article on the front page of the Sunday Telegraph in Sydney, which is a News Corp title. Now, as you say, the website doesn't have much of a call to action. It has logos from all of the major commercial media companies. It was actually only registered a few days ago, and it wasn't initially obvious who was actually behind it.
And that is what makes me nervous, Tim, when you have these powerful, wealthy people calling on us to stand up against things that really matter, like anti-Semitism and Islamophobia and that sort of all-encompassing term of hate. But it's not clear to me what they want consumers to do with that message or who's funding it or why. I just wasn't sure what has compelled all of these powerful people to get on board and what they want us to do with that information.
I think let's give it a little bit of the benefit of the doubt. I did a little bit of digging this week. So what I was able to find out was that behind the scenes, the person who I think was really the driving force of this project was Hamish McLennan, who Medialand listeners might remember as previously been a guest here on the show. So he's got a foot in a couple of camps, as well as his day job of being chair of ARN Media, which makes him Kyle Sanderlands' boss. He's also close to News Corp because he also chairs REA Group, which is their real estate platform. And back in the day, he was also, when he worked in advertising, he was Russell Howcroft's boss, Russell being another one of these voices.
Yeah, so what is compelling Hamish to do this then, I guess, would be the question. And I suspect some activist groups and commentators might take issue with it, given the ongoing campaign about some things that Kyle Sanderlands has said on radio in the past, whether that be his comments about monkeypox being the big gay disease, whether that be comments about Special Olympians and the Paralympics that got him in hot water. And now he's here saying things that, as I said, we agree with. These hateful things should stop. But I guess there is a bit of an issue with the delivery of the message, and maybe more will make sense when we see more from this campaign.
Yeah, and I suppose, you know, if you're going to make the case for what voices do you want, then in Sydney, Carl Sanderlands is often the top rating presenter. In Melbourne, it's Russell Howcroft is the top rating presenter. So these are people who have a voice, and whether one likes them or not, they do have a dedicated following. But there is one other bright spot which occurs to me, though, Viva. Normally the media companies hate each other, so just getting all of their logos onto one website does feel like a breakthrough.
A big day for media.
You're listening to Medialand on ABC Radio National. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Vivian Kelly. And in case you missed it...
Good evening. We'll have more on our breaking news out of Rome with the reports that the Pope has died. More on that shortly.
To breaking news now, and the Vatican has announced 88-year-old Pope Francis has died.
Now, I would just like to interrupt this broadcast with some breaking news out of Europe. Reports now that Pope Francis, the Pontiff, has passed away. We'll take you now live to Sky News UK.
This started before Trump took office. It shouldn't be all on Marco Rubio to act.
The Pope has died. That is a tragedy. But I am going to show you something that really is disgraceful. How the ABC celebrated Easter Sunday.
Well, good to see that Andrew Bolt plays to type, not using the opportunity like the Pope dying to have a go at the ABC. So the Pope's death has been covered pretty much from every angle, Viv, from his childhood identity to his fashion sense.
And it's something that the media would have been preparing for weeks. He spent time in hospital. He did seem to get better in time for the Easter weekend and appeared briefly in public.
If this sort of news can ever be seen as having good timing, then for the news networks, this was it. It broke just about 2 minutes before the 6 p.m. bulletins went to air on the East Coast.
But it was very unfortunate timing for the Radio National Hour with Fran Kelly. Fran's show was about to go to air at 6:05 p.m., leading with a seemingly pre-recorded interview about the Pope's autobiography. So 20 minutes later, when the news was all over the internet, here was Fran talking to Miles Patterdon, Catholic Church historian and commentator.
Miles, just finally, the Pope has been very, very unwell, you know, on the edge of death, we were told several times. He's out of hospital now. Your book, Electing the Pope, describes the economy of knowledge that's traditionally surrounded the health and well-being of the Pope. Do you have any insight into what might be happening behind the scenes in the Catholic Church at the moment? Will preparations be underway, jostling, you know, between front runners to be the next Pope? And are there thoughts of retirement in Francis's mind?
Thoughts of retirement on his mind, that is an awkward one, but it is hard to prepare when something breaks on a public holiday. All the networks would have had their plans in place for this kind of breaking news, but sometimes it doesn't work. So we thought we'd ask an insider what it's like to prepare for a big event like this, and of course, what happens when it goes wrong. Alan Sunderland is a former editorial director at the ABC, and he's kindly come into our studios. Thank you, Alan.
Hi there.
Alan, we will come on to what went wrong with that Radio National broadcast in a moment, but let's start with a more general point. There are certain people that newsrooms have to be ready to cover their passing appropriately, have a plan beforehand. Who's on that list? How many people? How do you prepare?
Oh, look, it's a constantly changing list, and it would have varying degrees of importance attached to them. To be honest, there wouldn't be that many. Obviously, the Queen, the Pope is on that list. There would be others. I suspect the Dalai Lama would probably be on that list. I don't want to mention two other names. I don't want to jinx them. But the reality is that newsrooms know that when certain people die or when certain big events happen, elections, referendums, Australia Day, there is going to be a demand for a lot of service. And of course, modern media, there's a lot of mouths to feed, 24-hour news services and constant requirements. So the longer you have to prepare and the bigger you think the issue is going to be, the more it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy that the engine of coverage starts to drive itself into gear and produce all sorts of talent on tap, obits prepared, programming plans put in place, travel plans. It just becomes a huge logistic operation.
People's expectations are so high now as well with the internet that if the Pope died and 20 minutes later you didn't have your story up and then your follow-up story about the reaction to the news, people would think you'd really dropped the ball. So I don't know if people realise how much of this work is pre-done, because if you started writing your story once you got the news that the Pope died, the whole internet and news cycle would have moved on by the time you caught up.
Yes, and there's two things about that. I think people are smart enough to know that programs have obits and talent lined up prepared for that day. Of course, it then becomes the case of can you put it into action at 3 o'clock in the morning if that's when the event happens. But there's a difference here. In my day, because I'm ancient, all you had to do was work out your programming for set piece news bulletins and things like that. Sometimes you had time. Now it's instant. And so if something happens that has been planned and is envisaged and foreseeable, yes, you expect a fair amount of packaged content. Where it gets very tricky is when something happens unexpectedly and you haven't done the preparation and you have open microphones and live rolling news channels where you've instantly got to scramble. And that's where people like you two get paid an awful amount of money, as we know, so that you can just chat away endlessly until someone ropes some talent up and gets them into the studio.
And obviously we touched on the unfortunate thing that it so happened. It was the long weekend. Fran Kelly's show had been pre-recorded, although it was a kind of news-based show. How would the ABC justify the fact that that show was pre-recorded, so had that embarrassing moment? I guess you understand the ABC's culture. Do you think they'll learn any lessons or they'll do anything differently as a result?
It'll happen again. I can promise you that. And it's happened before. I once famously went to air on SBS talking about the prospects for a Tasmanian government and its survival minutes after the Premier had gone to Government House and handed in his resignation. So we've all done it and we all cringe at the memory of it. But look, it is a difficult thing to do. I mean, let's be honest, I feel for the Fran Kelly team. You can absolutely imagine how it can happen. And then the problem becomes, what do you do at the moment that it happens? Do you junk the entire program? What do you replace it with? How do you deal with that? How do you manage it? Some outlets have the capacity to break in and update, to come in at the end and say, let's crash out of it early and do a little update. You do what you can to salvage it. But the dirty little truth about the media is that a lot of programs for financial, budgetary and planning reasons are pre-recorded. And then it becomes a question of what do you do on Radio National, for example, when the news is rolling out live on news radio and on the 24-hour news network? How do you react and how quickly do you react? And we all get judged for that.
Well, we should disclose that this show is first going to be heard on Friday and is being recorded on Thursday. So, you know, we're certainly part of that conversation.
Yeah, if I cark it overnight, don't run this.
I promise we'll run in and do an update. We've got your obituary ready to go, Alan. Don't worry.
I suppose the joking aside, and I hear what you say about budgets, but there is a serious point. Isn't it expected of the ABC that news-based programming should be live? You know, it does feel like it was a howler.
Yes, but I guess the question is, what is news-based programming? Is it a daily up-to-the-minute news piece? Is it a conversation piece? There are levels of risk and levels of calculation at all times in that. And all I'd say is that occasionally those judgments fall foul of reality and it catches up with you and you get exposed for it. So they're fine judgments to be made, but any program that's dealing with current issues and current events has the potential to be caught out when it pre-records.
Now, I know there'll be people listening, Alan, who will be frustrated that even Medialand is talking about the death of the Pope. It's a massive news story. And lots of people do want to hear about it and do care about it. But on the flip side, there's always those who think enough is enough, move on. We don't need wall-to-wall coverage of this issue. So how hard is it to know how far to go and what the audience tolerance or appetite is for a particular story?
That's a very difficult thing to judge, and I'm certainly not going to express a view on this program as to whether the ABC coverage of the Pope has been excessive as a lapsed Catholic myself or not excessive. What I will say, though, is that I'm a little bit weird in that if I think there's too much coverage, I stop listening. I stop watching and I stop reading. I don't hate watch it and then complain. So, but look, there are certain things you can be sure of in the media. One is that you will be criticised on any major story for covering it too much, because there will be people out there who are sick of it and they'll let you know. I guess the one point I'd make that's probably instructive is that there's an entire machinery that comes into place that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy when it comes to a big story like this. The more time you have to prepare, that there is always a risk of overkill for two reasons. One is, let's take the ABC as an example. The ABC is a loose federation of nation states when it comes to programs. You're lucky if Radio National knows what local radio is doing and what local streaming news are doing, let alone whether they care. Each program cares more about its own audience than the overall planning. Very difficult to do overall planning. And everybody looks for their own angle, their own talent. There's a very competitive situation. And so that tends to lead inevitably to more rather than less.
Do you think that the calculation is different for the commercial broadcasters as well when they're weighing up audience interest? I presume it's much more purely about ratings then.
Look, I've never worked for commercial TV. I respect it deeply, commercial radio. I'm not a beast of the commercial markets, but there is no doubt that there is a very significant factor in play for commercials, which is, will it rate? Is it something our audience want? The ABC gets that as well, but in the ABC it's also overlaid about a sense of responsibility as the national broadcaster. We have a duty to do things, and never let us forget that there's an army of ABC critics, some good faith, some bad faith, who are ready to pounce on the ABC if it feels it doesn't care about the Pope or it doesn't care about the Queen. So that's an added level of pressure that the public broadcasters around the world have to cover. They feel it's a sense of their duty and responsibility to leave no stone unturned when it comes to these stories.
Look, there have been some text messages that have come in complaining about too much coverage of the Pope's death. In your experience, Alan, is that people just venting because they do feel that sense of ownership and connection with the ABC? Or do these texts actually translate into becoming formal complaints?
Oh, look, you rarely get formal editorial. My life was exploring editorial errors. These are matters of judgment and taste more than anything else. And so the reason, particularly with a figure like the Pope, the Catholic Church is a polarising institution. You will get people who are angry because they've carefully measured the ABC coverage over all of the outlets and they think it's too much. You'll get people who are angry because their favourite program's gone off air. And you'll get people who are angry because they don't like what the Catholic Church represents and it becomes a political issue for them. You bundle all of those together and you will get a flood of complaints guaranteed.
We've also marked Anzac Day this weekend, another major moment in Australia's cultural life and one that the ABC has traditionally covered extensively. Does the ABC get complaints about that as well?
Yes. And Australia Day and every election and the voice referendum.
And don't forget the fireworks.
All of that. And look, I don't want to sound too dismissive of this because complaints are a rich source of genuine feedback from the public about what you're getting right and what you're getting wrong. So any decent organisation will look at those complaints, both the number of them and the nature of them, as well as looking at their ratings numbers, and see if they have any lessons to learn about getting it right. But the reality is that I tell a lot of broadcasters around the world who come to me for advice on editorial standards, if you're hoping to do something that will eliminate complaints, just give up now because they'll always be there. They'll always be around.
One complaint that did exist on social media with the coverage of the Pope's death was some people felt like mainstream media across the world weren't giving enough weight or attention to the Pope's comments on what's happening in Gaza and his support for the people there. How do you weigh up those decisions when you've got somebody who's been alive for decades and decades and had this very prominent career? To some people, that was the Pope's most important and progressive stance. And for other people, it was very polarizing. And so then you have people taking to social media saying, why are you ignoring this huge part of his life and personality and progressivism? So where do you even start with a life that big?
You're absolutely right. And whenever I was in the chair and I would get complaints like that, the first thing I'd do would be to say, have we covered it? Have we covered it at all? Because none of the complainants get to see the whole breadth of everything that the organisation does. So, for example, I found out that Pope Francis rings the one surviving Catholic church in Gaza every week through the media coverage. But we will have complaints that we have ignored the difficult things about him or not promoted the good things enough. People have said, why haven't you talked enough about the fact that he didn't do enough for pedophiles? Why haven't you talked about his difficult relationship with the Argentine generals? There's all manner of those things. And inevitably, you do get a bit of hagiography when someone dies. They tend to focus on the good points. But you would like to think that over the breadth of coverage, if you look for those issues, they're there. And it will always be a matter of contest as to whether that balance is right.
Alan Sunderland, former editorial director at the ABC, thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure. I'll go back to listening to the Vatican Rag now.
All righty, Viv. Any other business before we wrap up?
Well, I was really struck by this Seven News report about a carjacking on the Sunshine Coast. They interviewed two witnesses who are twins, and they speak in total sync with each other. It's quite something. Have a listen.
And one guy, he was up there with our mum, and he went up there, and
he was coming back down towards us,
and he goes, run, he's got a gun. And our heart started to pound, and I said, oh, mum, where's mum?
So those voices we just heard, Tim, were Bridget and Paula Powers interchangeably. They're famous twins from the Sunshine Coast, and their mum was witness to the carjacking. This video interview has gone viral locally. They've been on The Project, and it's also going viral internationally just because people are so taken aback by how in sync these two women are. You already knew about these twins, Tim. They're not new to you.
Yeah, this is one of the fascinating things, that the media does seem to rediscover them every few years. They, I guess, became sort of prominent animal rights campaigners, at least locally, for one thing. But yes, I have a hunch that give it another few years and the same moment will happen all over again.
Well, as you mentioned, people on the Sunshine Coast do already know them. They were inspired by Steve Irwin and went on to work at Australia Zoo and then started their own charity, Twinnies Pelican and Seabird Rescue, which they've been running for 25 years. And as you say, it's not even their first time in the media. Back in 2021, a video of them went viral and they were labelled the most annoying twins in the world by the British public, which seems a little too harsh. And they ended up on Good Morning Britain with Piers Morgan, which is perhaps an even harsher punishment.
Remember to follow Medialand on the ABC Listen app.
And we would love to hear from you. What media story would you be doomsday prepping for if you were in charge of a newsroom? Email us at medialand@abc.net.au.
Thank you to our producer, Catherine Zengaro. We'll catch you same time next week in your feeds and on Radio National.
See you, Tim.
Toodle pip, Viv.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.